Okay. So we have now come to the right effort of the Noble Eightfold Path, factor number six. And so as just to recap very briefly on what we have done already, we have seen how the Noble Eightfold Path is a path of gradual purification, and you start off with purifying the more coarser defilements in the mind. And those coarser defilements in the mind are purified by basically the virtue, the external virtue of right speech and right action and also right livelihood. And once those coarser defilements are purified, then of course you can start to work on the more refined things. So this is actually working with the mind itself, and this is what the right effort is all about, working with the mind, overcoming the defilements of the mind. And of course there is some kind of, there is some overlap here. Once you start working with the mind, that also has an effect back on right action and right speech. So these things kind of work with each other here. If the mind becomes more pure, it's much more easy to have right speech and right action as a consequence. And I think a lot of the things that we see in right effort, some of these things are very crucial for being able to live the spiritual life all the way to the full, and especially for the monastic life. If the monastic life is going to be successful and it's going to be sustainable in the long run, many of the things in the right effort are really crucial. This is kind of the area where you work that enables you to move towards samadhi, enables you to move towards meditation practice. Unless this is done correctly, that whole thing will basically stop. So it's a very crucial part of the path, I think, and one that needs to be understood to be able to take this practice further and all the way. So for that reason, I will spend a little bit of effort, a little bit of right effort on this, a little bit of time on this area. And a lot of it will be repetition of what I did here a couple of years ago, but I think it's very, this is a very important area, so I personally, I don't mind repeating myself quite a bit, because these are very important issues. Okay, so first of all, we look at the analysis, which is the same sutta as we've seen before, the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Magga Sanyutta number 8, the Vibhanga Sutta. And this is how right effort is analyzed in this sutta. And what, bhikkhus, is right effort? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu generates desire for the non-arising of unarisen, evil or bad, if you like, bad, unwholesome states or qualities. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind and strives. He generates desire for the abandoning of arisen, evil or bad, unwholesome qualities. He generates desire for the arising of unarisen wholesome qualities. And he generates desire for the maintenance of arisen wholesome qualities, for their non-decay, increase, expansion, and fulfillment by development. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. This is called right effort. So this is the summary of how right effort is done. And just very briefly here, evil is the translation for the Pali word papa. And I think bad is a much better translation. Evil is this kind of very Christian term, which doesn't really belong in a Buddhist text, in my opinion. And again, states, dhamma, I think, again, qualities is a better translation for that. So there's four things there, and they kind of work in a sort of unison, right? First of all, you try to avoid the arising of the unwholesome states, right? Basically, what do we mean by unwholesome qualities here? Well, again, it is the two first of the five hindrances, which are the most important of the bad qualities, right? So it's karma, chanda, and vyapada, which are the two main ones. Ill will and sensual desire. This is the main thing that is meant by unwholesome qualities. So right, so this is the first one. So first of all, you try to avoid these things to arise in the first place. There's a sequence here. Everything is sequential in the in Buddhism. So there's a sequence here. You try to avoid their arising here. If they do arise, after all, then you try to abandon them, right? So there's a second one, abandoning the unwholesome states. So these two things go together here. Then when you have gotten some way in abandoning and the and succeeding in the non-arising of the bad states, then also you generate the good states. This is the reverse side of the coin. So you generate the desire for the arising of unarisen wholesome states. So what are these wholesome states or wholesome qualities? The bad qualities are kama, chanda, and vyapada, and the wholesome qualities are usually, certainly in one context, are said to be the bodhrangas. The bodhrangas, the seven factors of awakening, right? And the seven factors of awakening are very closely related to the very first sutta we saw on this retreat, the sutta about how the process, the psychology of meditation works. We go through all those beautiful states, pamuja, piti, pasaddi, sukha, and then samadhi, right? All the happinesses. So basically, what we're trying to give rise to here, the wholesome states, we're trying to give rise to the process of meditation itself. That is what we're trying to give rise to. Stage by stage, right? Deeper and deeper happiness, deeper and deeper contentment, deeper and deeper tranquility as we move along here. And then the last one, which is then the maintenance of those states. So once they start to arise, you want to maintain them. And then you want not just to maintain them, but you want to learn how to improve them and increase them and fulfill them through development, right? So you keep on doing it until you reach the peak of these states. This is, in this particular case, it is in this particular sutta, which is the next one, I have actually left that out. This is explained as how to do the corpse meditation, right? How to, once you have kind of a good nimitta of a, of a corpse in your mind, right, whatever that is, then you kind of maintain that corpse nimitta in your mind. But I think it is just as easy or just as well to look at it as a maintenance of the bodhrangas, the seven factors of awakening. The corpse meditations are not that central to the Buddhist path, whereas the bodhrangas are much more central. So it might be better to think of it as that. So this is how it works then, right? First of all, you avoid the bad states from arising. If they do arise, you get rid of them through the right kind of effort. And then, on the other hand, you give rise to all the good states that haven't arisen, and then you maintain and fulfill them until you reach the highest stage. So this basically includes, in a sense, the whole path is almost included right there in the four right efforts. And the important aspect of this thing, which really is the thing that we are going to discuss over the next hour or so, is this idea of generates desire, right? Makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind and strives. What does that mean? How do we do that? How do we strive? How do we apply ourselves in such a way that these things actually come about? That is the crucial issue here. So this is what we're going to look at. And I will start straight away with looking at the first two of these. And usually the first one, the non-arising of unarisen bad wholesome states, is usually referred to as sense restraint. This is Indriya Sangvara in Pali, Indriya Sangvara Sila, and this is what comes up next. So this is, I'll have a quick look at that. This is a very important part of the gradual training, and because of that, I want to talk about this briefly before I look again at how this actually is done in practice. So this is how it reads. This is the next sutta here called restraint. Because there are these four strivings, four padana. So this is a reference to the four right efforts. What for? Striving by restraint, striving by abandonment, striving by development, and striving by protection. And the first one, what bhikkhus is the striving by restraint? So this is the one where we avoid unarisen, unwholesome qualities from arising here. Here, having seen a form with the eye, a bhikkhu does not grasp at its marks and features. Since if he left the eye faculty unrestrained, bad, unwholesome qualities of longing and dejection might invade him. He practices restraint over the eye. He guides the eye faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the eye faculty. Having heard a sound with the ear, exactly the same thing is repeated for each sense, having smelled an odor with the nose, having tasted a taste with the tongue, having felt a tangible object with the body, having cognized a mental phenomenon with the mind. Bhikkhu does not grasp its marks and features. Since if you left the mind faculty unrestrained, bad, unwholesome qualities of longing and dejection might invade him. He practices restraint over the mind. He guards the mind faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the mind faculty. This is called striving by restraint. So this is the restraining. This is how we avoid the bad qualities from arising in the first place. Specifically, as I mentioned before, kamachanda and vyapada. And let's just look at this in a little bit detail, because this is not necessarily very obvious what is going on here, just to get some clarity about what is happening here. So having seen a form with the eye, right? You see something with the eye, anything basically. You know, you all the time we're seeing stuff. Then, when you do that, you sometimes, as you do that, there are certain things that you see that will kind of catch your eye, right? Suddenly you see something, it catches your eye. And the things that catches your eye are the things that usually you find either pleasing or you find repelling. So if it catches your eye and you find it pleasing, it tends to stick, right? It sticks in your eye, and sometimes afterwards, you often end up thinking about these things as well, precisely because you find it pleasing. Yeah. This is what this is all about. It is the idea that you see something with the eye, then you do not grasp its marks and features. Nimitta and vyanjana is what here. So nimitta can mean the whole object itself, and the vyanjana is often like the lesser aspects of that object that you are seeing, right? So if you see a person, that could be the nimitta, you see a whole person, and then the lesser aspect could be any part of that person, the eyes, or the hair, or the nose, or whatever it is. This is what is meant here. It just means anything we see, anything that comes in through our eyes. And then we grasp that. It means it tends to stick in our eye. We remember it afterwards, and it comes back to us later on. And this means that we have had some reaction to that object, right? It is pleasing. It is something we delight in. Or we find it repelling. If we find something repelling, it also sticks in the mind, and we think about it afterwards. This is a natural reaction of the senses. If we don't see anything that is either pleasing or that we don't like, the field of vision just moves on, right? It moves on and on until we see something else that we like or dislike. And then we grasp again. The grasping happens. It's not that we grasp. It happens almost automatically, right? It's just something that happens in life. Kind of you stop and it happens by itself. So what we want to do, we want to check that automatic process. We want to kind of hold it, basically, so we don't have that automatic process happening in the same way here. So he does not grasp the marks and feature. He kind of just moves on, right? There's no kind of holding on to these things. Since if he left the eye faculty unrestrained, bad, unwholesome qualities of longing and dejection might invade him. And this is exactly what I was talking about here, longing and dejection. I don't like this translation personally. It really, abhijja and domanasa, abhijja means like desire, basically. So abhijja, you get desire for the thing you see. You see something nice, right? You like it. And as a consequence of the liking, tanha tends to arise. Desire or craving arise as a consequence. So a good, a possible translation for abhijja and domanasa might be something like liking and displeasure, perhaps. You like something, or it is disliking, liking and disliking, liking or displeasure, a desire and aversion. All of these things are possibilities. Domanasa is any kind of displeasure with the mind. Abhijja is any kind of desire in the mind. And this is what happens with this. This is how we react to the sensory world, right? Either we're liking or we're disliking him. So this is what we're trying to avoid, because once we start liking things or disliking things, craving is just behind. Craving is right there. And then when craving arises, then the mind gets distorted and we have a problem. So you practice the restraint over the eye faculty. You guard the eye faculty and you undertake the restraint of the eye faculty. So what does that mean? And it means two things. How can we undertake this restraint of the eye faculty? There's two things that we have to do here. And the first thing is you have to have mindfulness, right? You have to have a certain degree of mindfulness, not kind of absolute, the highest quality of mindfulness, but you have to have enough mindfulness to be aware of what's happening in your mind. Is your mind leaning towards desire or leaning towards aversion? Or are you able to see what is happening in your mind? Is it going in such a direction or not? This is the first thing you have to have. You have to have awareness to know what is going on. Then once you have enough awareness to know what is going on, then you have to have a strategy, or you have to have a perception, or you have to have a way of thinking in place that can counteract any tendency towards desire or towards aversion. So if you have enough mindfulness and you see that the mind is being led towards liking and disliking, towards craving and aversion, towards displeasure and desire, then you have the strategy there. You know how to think in such a way that you can abandon that idea straight away. You don't actually fall for the trap, right? You don't fall for the desire, fall for the aversion, and you're able to lead the mind away from that. And this is the most important thing for sense restraint, is this ability to have perceptions in your mind, perceptions that are ready. It's like you have this whole shelf, this shelf full of perceptions, right? And you pull down the right perception at the right time to counteract any problem that might arise in the mind. This is kind of one of the most important things here. So if you see that desire is about to arise in the mind, then you have a perception which ensures that we stop the desire in its track before it grasps hold of the mind. Once it kind of gets stuck in the mind, it is very hard to get rid of it. So this is why mindfulness is so important. The stronger the mindfulness, the earlier on you're able to catch the mind moving in this way, the more powerful will be, or the greater will be your ability to use your perceptions, to use your wisdom to actually stop that from happening here. So this is sense restraint. And it's very interesting because often when we talk about the word restraint in English, it often seems to imply a degree of force, right? We force ourselves, we restrain. But actually, and this is one of the things that we will see in the sutta later on, the most powerful kind of restraint is not using force, is not using willpower, but is using precisely the type of wisdom power, if you like, wisdom, understanding, perceptions, that is much more effective if you want to avoid these kind of things. It's more effective, it's less taxing, less unpleasant than using willpower. It is far, far better to use wisdom power if you can do that. But it takes a bit of work. You have to think about these things. This is the problem with wisdom. You have to develop that wisdom first of all. But once it is developed, it becomes a very powerful tool in guiding the mind in the right way. So this is a restraint of the eye. Then you have exactly the same kind of restraint with the five other senses, including the mind. So you're also guarding the mind all the time. In the mind, we also have the same problem because the mind takes the other five senses as its objects, right? You can dream about things in your dreams. You can hear, you can see, you can do all kinds of stuff. So the mind itself is capable of taking the other senses as its object. So that is restraint. That is what is meant by restraint in the suttas. And this is how we avoid the arising of unwholesome states in the mind. So that is the first introduction to this. We're going to come back to this again and again, this both now and also tomorrow morning, hopefully. So we're going to look at this in more detail to get a deeper understanding of how this is done. So that is the restraint. The next one is the striving by abandonment. In other words, what happens if something already arises, right? You get some desire, it kind of lodges in your mind, you can't get rid of it all that easily, or you get some ill will coming up, then what do we do? And the process is very, very similar to the one where we strive for the non-arising. It's basically the same thing. We try to use wisdom power, if at all possible, rather than using willpower. It's much more effective and much less unpleasant to do it that way. So this is the little paragraph here for how this is explained. And what is striving by abandonment? Here, a bhikkhu does not tolerate an arisen sensual thought. He abandons it, dispels it, terminates it, and obliterates it. He does not tolerate an arisen thought of ill will, an arisen thought of harming. Bad, he does not tolerate bad, unwholesome qualities whenever they arise. He abandons them, dispels them, terminates them, and obliterates them. This is called striving by abandonment. It's pretty strong, isn't it? Strongly worded. Terminates and obliterates, right? Whoa, it sounds like you're going to war or something against these things. And in a way, I suppose we are. We are going to war, but it's a very gentle kind of war. It's a very wise kind of war. It's a war using wisdom and not using any anger or ill will or force. And again, this is kind of the important point here. That when you see those words, you have to be very careful. This is where interpretation of the suttas and understanding things properly is so important. If you don't know your suttas very well, if you haven't cross-referenced, seen the suttas from many different angles, you might think this means using incredible amount of willpower, right? You're going to obliterate these things. Well, obviously, that must mean willpower. But no, and this is the interesting thing, if you want to obliterate something, willpower is never going to use, never going to work. Willpower will suppress things, tend to hold them down, but it will not actually be able to get rid of something. To really get rid of something, you have to use wisdom power. Wisdom gets rid of things like that when it's used correctly. It is the only way to actually be able to obliterate something. This is quite interesting, isn't it? You actually, wisdom is what obliterates. Will does not obliterate, it can only really keep things in check. So this is a very important point to keep in mind, and we will see this further as we move on to the next sutta. So now I'm going to move on to that sutta. This is called the Dveda Vitakka Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, Two Kinds of Thoughts. And it is one of my favorite suttas, how to deal with the thinking mind, how to deal precisely with these areas of directing the mind in the right direction. And in this sutta, the Buddha is talking about his own experience before his awakening, so what he did. And please remember that when you read suttas where the Buddha talks about his own experience, and there's a large number of these suttas. There's this one here, there's the one after. There is Majjhima Nikaya 4, the Bhayabhairava Sutta, there's the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Mahasachika Sutta, the Bodhirajakumara Sutta, there is the Upakilesa Sutta. There's a large number of suttas where the Buddha does kind of autobiographical accounts of his own life. He talks about himself, what he did. So why does the Buddha do that? He doesn't just do that to kind of, you know, to kind of say how amazing he is and how marvelous he is. The obvious reason why he does that is because it shows his example. This is what I did. You should be doing the same thing, right? This is the obvious reason. And the way he talks is always in a very practical way. He says, this is how I overcame wrong view. This is how I overcame defilements. This is how I guided my mind towards samadhi, towards the deep insights on the path. It's very, very practical. And it's obvious that the Buddha is teaching us how we also should be doing these things. And this is so important, right? The Buddha is the example. We follow that example after him. And to be able to work with this in a proper way, it is so important then that we understand the Buddha as a human being just like us. One of the dangers, I think, sometimes in the Buddhist world, this is certainly true in Mahayana Buddhism, but I think it's true in Theravada Buddhism very often as well, sometimes we lift the Buddha up too high. The Buddha becomes almost like a god, right? He is omniscient. He has these qualities that nobody else has. Now, if the Buddha has qualities that nobody else has and is beyond ordinary human beings, then what he practices becomes kind of irrelevant. If he's different from us, well, that was his practice. We can't do that anywhere because he's different. It becomes irrelevant. But the whole point is that the Buddha is not different from us. He is the same. You read the sutta as he talks about his defilements. He talks about his wrong view. He talks about being attached to his family, his wife and children. It's exactly the same things that we are experiencing in our life. Yes, he was wise because he had to find the path for himself, right? That is what makes him so special, that he was able to find this without any help. But apart from that, he is very similar to what we are. So it's important to, yes, the Buddha was, what he discovered and what he became as a Buddha, of course, is worthy of tremendous respect. But at the same time, while we respect him in a very, very high way, we also have to remember that he was human. And when we remember that he was human, then these suttas become very, very powerful, because then we really see that we should be practicing in the same way, following in the Buddha's footsteps. That's the idea here. So please keep that in mind. And to me, that makes the whole Buddhism come alive much more when we understand the Buddha in the right way. So this is how this sutta goes. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's grove and at Pindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, venerable sir, they replied, and the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, before my awakening, while I was still an unawakened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming, or thoughts of ruthlessness, and I said on the other side, thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-harming him. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. I will stop there. Here the Buddha is clearly talking about himself, right, before his awakening. And he's talking about his time. He says here, while he was still an unawakened, unabhisambuddho. Unabhisambuddho means quite literally unawakened. It does not, unenlightened is a much less literal translation. And I personally, I like the idea of not being awakened or awakening rather than enlightenment. It's more, I feel it's much more meaningful to talk about awakening than enlightenment. And he says an unawakened bodhisattva. Now this is, of course, interesting that the word bodhisattva occurs here. And one of the things that you find in the Pali Sutta is that the way the word bodhisattva is used, it is almost always used of the Buddha after the time he went forth into the homeless life. That is when the word bodhisattva starts to be used, right? That's when he is a bodhisattva. When after he leaves the home life and goes out in search for awakening, for an end to all the problems in the world, death, old age and illness and all these kind of things. There are a couple of suttas where the term occurs at an even earlier stage. One of those is the Acharya Buddha Sutta. But the Acharya Buddha Sutta is a sutta which is less reliable in terms of through again comparative studies with the Chinese version of these suttas, you can often see how much change has happened in the suttas. And the Acharya Buddha Sutta is a sutta where quite a lot of change has happened, and the Chinese version is quite different from the Pali version. It is possible that there the usage is slightly different. I take the usage of bodhisattva to mean the Buddha, after he has left the home life and is searching for awakening. It is not used of somebody who has been going on for eons and eons in samsara, right? Going on and on, trying to find awakening. It is not used like that. That is a later development and a later usage of this word, bodhisattva. In the suttas, it just refers to this life. That is when he started the search. And the word bodhisattva itself is quite interesting. Usually the Sanskrit rendering is bodhisattva, right? And bodhisattva means bodhi is awakening, sattva is being. So it's like awakening being, right? It's a bit strange, isn't it? Awakening being? What does that mean? Awakening being? It's not entirely clear what that is supposed to mean. And this was professor of Sanskrit at Oxford University. He is now retired, Professor Richard Gombrich. And he writes lots of articles on Buddhism, and lots of articles on Sanskrit language and all these kind of things. He said that bodhisattva, it may not actually mean bodhisattva. Sometimes the way these words are formed, it may have been bodhisatta first, and then bodhisattva may have been formed afterwards, depending on how the flow of history kind of goes, and how the language, different languages arise from the kind of core original language. It is not entirely clear how these words develop, right? And so he suggested that instead of the word being bodhisattva, it should perhaps be bodhisakta. Now, bodhisakta is a Sanskrit word which means somebody who is searching for awakening, right? The one who is searching for awakening, roughly searching or aiming for, or something like that. And that kind of makes more sense, right? The one who is searching or aiming for awakening is, to me, certainly makes more sense than awakening being or awakening, you know. To me, that is much more obscure. I guess both are possible, but I like this idea of bodhisakta. So I think perhaps the good Professor Gombrich might have a point in this particular case. Just a small point of interest for those of you who are interested in such matters. So, he was the awakened bodhisatta, which in Pali becomes bodhisatta, right? In Pali, the word is the same. So, in Pali, you can't tell whether the Sanskrit should be bodhisattva or bodhisatta. In Pali, because in Pali language, the way the Pali works, it doesn't make that distinction between those two words. So that's why in Pali, it is ambiguous, and we don't know exactly what it came from or what the meaning was. And this is how you can make these linguistic fun and games. This is what kind of the linguists kind of enjoy doing, this kind of stuff. So this is what he did, right? He divided his thoughts into two classes. And on the one side, he put all the defiled thinking, the sensual desire, the ill will, and the ruthlessness. On the one other side, he put the undefiled kind of thinking, the renunciation, in other words, the giving up of sensual pleasures, the non-ill will, metta, and non-harming, or compassion, if you like. And then it says here that, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, right? As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. In other words, being diligent, actually, it should really be heedful. Heedful is a better translation. This is appamada, right? Ardent is atapi. It means with energy, energetic, ardent. And resolute is pahitatta. Pahitatta is related to padana, to striving and effort. So as I abided this, I was being heedful, right? Heedful, I was striving, I was being energetic. So this is what that means. This is what being heedful means. This is what energetic means. Dividing your thoughts into two classes. That is the meaning, right? This is the way you abide diligent, heedful, and energetic. In other words, again, it shows you that this, of course, is about wisdom, the ability to divide your thinking in this way, and to understand that certain thoughts are defiled, other thoughts are pure, and to be able to do that, not only superficially, but in a very deep way, to understand the defilements all the way to the core, to the most refined defilements there are, and also to see the other states, the positive states, in all their expression, from the most refined to the highest. This is quite difficult. We know, of course, the most coarse expressions of the defilements, when we can see, when we have strong desires or strong anger, it's very obvious. But to see these things in the very most refined elements or aspects of these is actually quite difficult. But this is what the Buddha here says. This is what it means to be heedful, to be energetic, and to apply yourself in the right way. So again, you can see it is actually an aspect of wisdom. We apply wisdom, and by applying wisdom, that is how we are doing these things. So again, it's just showing you that interpretation of these words here is important, and how that interpretation can be done. So, he divides his thoughts into two classes, and then he has a full understanding of what these thoughts are in the whole scope and range and breadth of these thoughts. And once he has understood that, then of course he's able to look inside his mind and he's able to see whether these thoughts are there or not. So, as I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and with effort or resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose, kama vitaka, sensual desire arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered it leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. So, this is how the Buddha is practicing. This is how he is overcoming these thoughts, right? So this is what we should be doing as well. This is what he does. Now, one of the striking things here is that what the Buddha is doing here to overcome this sort of defiled thinking, he's using wisdom. He's understanding why these things are bad. And then he reflects on that. And by reflecting on that, he is abandoning these thoughts. Right? It's all about wisdom. And of course, then at the very end, it says that whenever these thoughts arise, I abandon them, remove them, did away with these thoughts. And these words here, abandon, remove, and did away with, are almost exactly the same words we saw before, which were the thoughts of terminating, obliterating. The Pali words are the same. Right? So now you can see what these things mean. Obliteration, termination of these things, actually refers to the using of wisdom. The Buddha is not using so much willpower here. He's thinking about these things in such a way that these things are abandoned. So this is how you cross-reference the suttas and you start to understand how these terms are used to get the proper idea of what is going on. It's about wisdom. It's not about willpower. And that's actually a great relief because willpower is often so painful and it's unsustainable, whereas wisdom power is actually, it also takes a certain amount of effort to develop that wisdom, but once it's developed, you can use it and apply it in this kind of way. So the first thing the Buddha does here, this is actually not the Buddha, this is the Buddha to be. The first thing he does is that he understands this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. So this is the first thing. So in other words, what that means is that, again, you have to understand the full range of sensual thinking, kama vitaka. Only when you understand the full range are you able to then to know that this thought has arisen in you. And as I said just a couple of minutes ago, this itself is actually quite difficult because sensual desire can be incredibly subtle and very refined, and it takes quite a lot of contemplation just to be able to understand fully how deeply this sensuality goes. It's often very, very refined things that can keep us trapped in sensuality. So this is the first thing. And then once you know that sensual desire has arisen, the thought of sensuality has arisen, the next thing is then how you think about this, right? And then he thinks, this leads to my own affliction, right? Sensual desire leads to my own affliction. This is the first thing he thinks. So this is what we have to think. We have to think this leads to my own affliction. But you can't just think that. You have to actually feel it. You have to know that it leads to your own affliction. It's not sufficient just to think it leads to my own affliction. You have to really understand it in a very deep way. And this is where wisdom power comes into the picture. Right? If you understand that it actually leads to your own affliction, then this kind of thought has tremendous power, because all you're doing is you're recollecting, you're bringing up that perception, you're bringing up the memory of the wisdom that you have built up in the past, bringing that to mind, and that then helps you to abandon this. So why is it that a sensual thought leads to your own affliction? it does, you know, sensual thoughts are very kind of interesting usually. They're kind of intoxicating. They're very kind of tend to, you know, they tend to kind of take you by the arm and lead you very softly. Come this way. It is so nice and pleasurable, you know, very, very gently. And then they kind of get you more and more entrapped as time goes by. But in the beginning, it seems so innocuous. It seemed like nothing. Why is this a problem? And to understand why this is a problem, you have to understand where it tends to lead, right? Where does sensual thinking lead you? And where it leads, it always leads towards, once you start thinking about sensuality, the next thing you do is you start to acquire those objects of sensuality. In ordinary life, you get into relationships, right? This is kind of the most basic kind of sensual experience, to have a relationship with somebody. This is sensuality here. So this is one way. But it's not just relationships. Sensuality expresses itself through acquiring all kind of things in life. Whenever we acquire something, whenever we want something and then move on to acquiring it, that is also an aspect of sensuality. All the things in life that we have acquired over time, right? Starting with relationships to all other things, that is part of the problem that arises as a consequence of sensual thought. It starts with sensual thought. It escalates up, and you acquire all these things. And once you acquire things, that is where attachment occurs. Once you're in a relationship, there's attachment there, right? And that's what a relationship is all about. There's always a certain degree of attachment. So sensuality always leads to attachment. You cannot really avoid that. If you keep on pursuing that sensuality, you don't counteract it, it leads to attachment. And once you are attached to people, to things, to whatever it is, even to ideas, then you are open to suffering. Attachment always ends in tears. Right? It always ends in tears. It always ends in suffering. It always ends in problems. Why? Because once you are attached to something, eventually that object, that person, that thing that you are attached to, eventually it will have to disappear. This is just the law of nature, anicca. Everything must disappear. Everything that is pleasing and agreeable to me will become otherwise. So the moment you are attached, that moment you can be absolutely sure you will suffer as a consequence. So understand that, you know, see that very deeply, that attachment, sensuality leads to attachment. Attachment leads to suffering. Attachment is a thing that has led to you going, roaming and wandering around samsara, right? For life after life, eon after eon, losing a mother, losing a father, losing a brother, losing a sister, and crying and wailing and weeping and, you know, suffering as a consequence. That is all it is about. This is how it works. So this is how you can understand. This is one way of understanding, and perhaps the main way of understanding why sensual thought is a problem. And when you remember that, as soon as a sensual thought starts to arise, and you have a very clear understanding, using your wisdom, where this is heading, it is heading towards suffering. That's where it's heading. Once you understand that, you pull back. It's as if you are grasping some hot coals, right? And you can kind of start to feel the heat in your hand. If you don't let go straight away, you're going to burn yourself very, very badly. You let go of the hot coals. You let go of the thought of sensual desire, the thought of sensual pleasures. This is how it works. This is how you use wisdom to abandon the thoughts of sensual desire. So that is your own affliction, right? Then it also leads to others' affliction. Why does thoughts of sensual desire, why do they lead to the affliction of other people? And again, it is because once there is sensual desire, then very often we protect our things. We protect the things we have. We guard them, right? And very often there is conflict. We are married to somebody, somebody else is also interested in this person, right? We are trying to get into a relationship with somebody, somebody else wants that person. And very often, because of our attachment again, it leads to conflict with the people around us. And some of the most violence in the world is often the violence, the crimes of passion, right? These are very, very common in the world. Especially people kill each other because of passion, because of attachment, because of love and all these things. That is where the highest, I think, number of murders happen, precisely because of that. And there are special laws around the world, laws about the, you know, like, that refer to the crimes of passion. And the sentencing is often not quite as strong as if it is a murder for other reasons, because people kind of recognize that if it is from attachment or love, then it's kind of a different type of crime almost. So again, it leads to conflict with others, right? It always leads to conflict with others once you are attached. And then you lose your mind, you lose your ability to see clearly, and you are willing to do anything to fight over the person you are attached to. Almost anything, to the point of murder, to the point of almost anything you can think of. So it leads to problems for others, sensual desire. And then the last one, it leads to affliction for both. In other words, it's not just me or just the other. In most cases, it's both people, both other people and ourselves that are affected badly by sensual desire. So this is how to reflect on these things. And as you reflect on that, as the Buddha says here, when I consider this, this leads to my own affliction. It subsided in me, right? It disappears. That's enough. Because you understand this is suffering. It goes in the wrong way. There's no way that you're going to hold on to suffering. So you just let go. Just like holding a hot coal in your hand. You don't realize it's a hot coal. The moment you realize it, you don't have to reflect, should I let go or not? You just go straight away. So this is the first part here, the first thing that he considers. The next thing he considers is that it obstructs wisdom. The Pali word here is Panya Nirodhika. Niroda means ending, ceasing, right? It makes wisdom cease, quite literally. In other words, what he is understanding here is that once you are in the, once desire gets a hold in your mind, your ability to see clearly is obstructed. You can't see clearly anymore. You no longer understand what is good for you and what is bad for you. It distorts your outlook. You're no longer able to really make proper decisions in life. This is one of the reasons why I always tell people, if you're going to make a decision about something, wait till your mind is clear. Never make a decision while the mind is in the has anger or desire. If you have anger or desire, you're never going to be able to make wise decisions. This is what he's saying here. It obstructs wisdom. You can't see clearly. Now, whole of Buddhism is about being wise. Life is really about being wise. Is there anybody who doesn't want to be wise? Isn't there something marvelous and wonderful about wisdom? Wisdom is this thing which allows us to live a good life. Wisdom is the thing which allows us to understand the difference between happiness and suffering. Wisdom is what allows us to move towards more happiness and away from suffering. It's about understanding life itself, understanding psychology, understanding what, you know, what existence is all about. So wisdom is this wonderful quality. To me, it is the highest of all the spiritual qualities. In fact, on the Buddhist path, that's how it often is. It reflects the Buddhist path. It always ends in wisdom. The highest wisdom is always found at the end. The highest of the five indriyas is the panyindriya, the indriya, the faculty of wisdom. So if it obstructs wisdom, then I don't want to have anything to do with it. And you know that it obstructs wisdom. Feel it for yourself. Feel what desire does to you when it's in your heart, and compare it to when it's not there. And you will be able to see very clearly that you cannot make rational, objective, good decisions in your life while you are sensual desire has got hold of you. All of these things is a matter of experience and a matter of thinking through these things properly that give rise to the wisdom that enables you to use these kind of reflections. Then he says it causes difficulties, right? This is similar to obstructs wisdom. It's just painful. Vigata pakika is the Pali word. Pakika means being on the side of. Vigata, I'm not entirely sure what it means, but it means something like difficulties, problems, perhaps even related to anger, perhaps. It's all this problematic side of life. So it is, causes difficulties. It is problematic. It is painful right here and now and causes difficulties. And it leads away from Nibbana. It leads away from extinguishment, right? If we translate Nibbana into English, it leads away from extinguishment. What is it that we're trying to extinguish? We're trying to extinguish lobha, dosa, and moha. We're trying to reduce the defilements, extinguish the defilements, so the mind becomes nice and balanced, nice and peaceful, and not kind of being the slave of these defilements, always driving us around from life to life and also within each life itself. So if you have a sense of what Nibbana is, this beautiful, cool heart, right, where you are free, free from all this being run around as a slave, then if it leads away from that, then you don't want to have anything to do with it. This is just a little bit about how to think in these cases, how to lead you away from sensual desire. This is very, very useful in monastic life, because obviously sensual desire is one of the biggest hindrances in monastic life, so it's very, very important. In lay life, it can also be important, it can be useful, especially when you are on retreat, and especially if you are very, very committed to the Buddhist practice, and some people are incredibly committed. I'm sometimes very impressed by some lay people, how committed they are to the path, and then these things can actually be very useful as a consequence. So, when you think like that, then it is, you remove it, you do away with it, you abandon it. Because the power of wisdom is that when you use the wisdom rightly, it is like the defilement just goes like that. Because you understand that this is dangerous. It's like letting go of dukkha. You don't want to have anything to do with it. And when you let go of it like that, it stays away. It doesn't come back very quickly. If you use willpower, it's like you're suppressing things. You're holding it down. And as soon as you abandon the willpower, it kind of comes back up again, right? It's painful to use willpower. It kind of tires you out. And it doesn't really work. After a while, it just comes back again. Wisdom power, once it is developed, is not so tiring. Once it works, bang, and it is gone for a fairly long time afterwards, because you have seen the dukkha, and the mind naturally just moves away from it. Sometimes you have to use a bit of willpower, true. Sometimes the defilements are just so bad, and the wisdom doesn't work, and all this kind of things. You have to use a bit of willpower, but we try as much as possible to use wisdom power instead. Okay. Let me now move on to the two other types of thoughts. I'm not going to spend so much time on them because they are much easier to see why these are problematic, but just very briefly. As I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and with effort, a thought of ill will arose in me, a thought of ruthlessness or harming arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of ill will, this thought of harming has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, leads away from Nibbana. When I considered thus, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of ill will or harming arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. So here we are looking at ill will, vyapada, and harming, which is a vihingsa. And I think it is much easier to understand why ill will is a problem, right? If you have ill will, you know what it's like to be around an angry person. It's very unpleasant. And nobody wants to do that. It just doesn't feel nice. And when we have ill will, we cause difficulties in our relationships, enormous difficulties. And we are often blinded. We do all kind of crazy things as a consequence of ill will. We say things we don't want. We break our precepts, all kind of stuff. I think it is fairly obvious why this is dangerous. So we try to subdue it as much as possible. And we understand that as long as there is a little bit of ill will left, a little bit of this defilement left in us, it has the potential to sprout up again. It's like a seed which is there, which can come back at any time and develop into something very ugly very fast. So for that reason, we don't even allow a little bit of ill will to remain in our mind. A little bit of kind of harshness or cruelty or harming towards other beings. All of that we abandon because it creates so much difficulties in our life and also in the life of people around us. And I think that everything in our world, all the wars that we have, all the problems that we have in our world, they all basically come from these defilements here. Desire to control things in the world, control other people, control resources, right? It's all about desire, about meeting the needs of your country or your people. And of course, ill will is also very much a part of it. If you're going to go out and shoot or kill others, you can't really do that. You have to have ill will to some extent, or at very least, you have to have this ruthlessness in you to be able to do that sort of thing. Certainly, if you have compassion, you won't be able to do these kind of things. So many problems. The vast majority of all the problems we have on a global scale, in a country scale, on a local scale, within the family, within ourselves, right? All kinds of scales. Everything basically comes from this. So for that reason, what a wonderful thing it is if at least we, as you know, or I, one person, if at least I can do something to alleviate or reduce things in myself, then I'm perhaps each one of us can become a beacon for the rest of humanity to move in the right direction and do something good in the world. Solving problems very often means solving it in oneself first of all, and then becoming hopefully become an example for others afterwards. Okay, I will go on a little bit longer. So this then comes the next paragraph here. And the Buddha says, "Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned the thoughts of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire, and that his mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will, upon thoughts of harming or ruthlessness, he has abandoned the thought of non-ruthlessness, non-ill will, to cultivate the thought of ruthlessness, or cruelty, harming, and then his mind inclines towards such thoughts." Right? So we learn to incline the mind in certain ways. Where your habits are, that is where your mind will incline. If you have a certain habit, your mind will tend by itself to go in that direction. So habits are always dangerous. And this is what I was talking about yesterday. When you look into your past life and you start to see that these habits, they have just been going on forever into the past, and you still have those habits in you, it gets a bit scary. You see how incredibly deep-rooted they are. And you know when you see that, you will take these habits with you also into the future, unless you do something about this now. Habits are very, very deeply ingrained in us. So this is why this kind of reflection is so powerful, because it has the ability to change our habits. Once you understand the danger, seeing the danger in sensuality is the same thing as having a thought of renunciation. When you see the danger in sensual pleasures, automatically you're moving towards not having those thoughts, and that itself is the thought of renunciation. Renunciation here, remember, means non-sensual thoughts. That's really what it means. So you learn that, and of course, once that becomes the habit of the mind, and this is a very gradual shift, right? Gradually shifting. Once that becomes the habit of the mind, it is so easy, right? Then it becomes so natural. You actually naturally think those thoughts. And when you naturally think those thoughts, then also your bodily actions and your speech also falls into place in accordance with that. So everything becomes so much easier as you practice this path. Everything kind of falls into place very naturally. So make these things into habits, and then you are going very well on this in this practice. Just as in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he would be flogged, imprisoned, fined, and blamed if he let those cows stray into the crops. So too I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation, and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. Right, it's the cowherd. He has all his cows, and in the autumn all the crops are coming out, right? And the cows are very keen to get into the crops and eat those crops. And so the only way you're going to stop them is to kind of poke them. Okay, cows, come this way, don't go that way. Right? So you poke them on this side, on that side, to make sure they don't go into the crops. What happens if the cows go into the crops? That cowherd is in big trouble, right? He gets flogged, imprisoned, fined, and blamed. In the same way, if we stray into the crops of sensual desire, we also get imprisoned by the suffering in the future, imprisoned by all the problems that arise from those thoughts of sensual pleasure in our mind, in the same way as our cowherd. So we have to tap our mind, poke our mind. Come now, mind, come this way, don't go that way. That is the way of dukkha, this is the way of sukha. Go according to sukha, not dukkha. That is the way we need to deal with our mind, just as the cowherd does. And then he says here, I saw in those unwholesome states the danger, right? He understands the danger in these things. Danger is ardinava in Pali. He sees the ardinava in these states. And this is what we need to do too. He sees the degradation, the okara. Okara means, okara, kara is from karoti, to make. And o is like low, you make low. You have like a low mind, right? It's like a low state. It's the opposite of the state of samadhi or brahmavihara, which is a high state. We feel the mind is lofty, the mind is expanded, the mind is beautiful. Here the mind is kind of contracted and small and mean. That's the kind of mind you have. This is the okara mind. And also the defilement, the mind being defiled, the mind being dirty, so to speak. It's like you don't feel good when the mind is dirty, just like anything which is dirty is not nice. And in wholesome states, you see the blessing of renunciation, having given all that up, put all that dukkha behind you, the aspect of cleaning the mind, of cleansing, cleaning yourself up, not being defiled, not being dirty, but feeling clean inside. The bright mind is a clean mind, right? Brightness and cleanness go together. And the bright mind, when meditation starts to bite and starts to work, is a beautiful mind. It feels incredibly good to have a bright and clean and pure mind. So you understand how these things work. You understand why defilements are a problem. And then this is how this whole thing goes. So I'm going to have to stop there. I had hoped to finish this sutta, but things always take longer than you think. And it's such a beautiful sutta. I really love this sutta. And I think it is so powerful that it may be nice to come back and just finish it off tomorrow morning very quickly. So I'm not really too sad about that. I'm quite. It's always nice to be able to do these things properly. So that is all for this afternoon, and I'll see you again this evening.